everybody. Hi there. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me today. I've been telling you that I've been in California for a while. I'm still here. For those of you who don't know, I'm normally in New York City. That's where I live. But for the last few years, we've been coming out to California around this time, and it's great to be able to travel around and check out the vegan scene on the left coast and visit some of my favorite eateries, which I've been taking a lot of advantage of. Okay, so I'm very, very excited and looking forward to the next half hour because we have a wonderful guest with us. And if you don't know her, you're going to find out how many people she has touched and influenced in such a positive way when it comes to veganism and nutrition. My guest is Jo Stepaniak, and she is an author and a co-author of more than 24 books on vegan cuisine, health, and compassionate living. Today we're going to focus on IBS, irritable bowel syndrome, which she has struggled with for decades, and she knows what it's like to feel that no food is safe even when eating healthy vegan fare. And as a result, we have her beautiful new book, Low FODMAP and Vegan. Welcome, Jo. How are you today?
I'm fine, Karen. How are you?
It's a beautiful day here. I am just bouncing off the walls. I'm feeling really exceptionally good today. I wanted to tell you, the last time I spoke with you was 7 years ago. You were one of my very first guests on this program, It's All About Food, and I'm very grateful for that. You gave us a very informative interview, and since that time here on the Progressive Radio Network, now in its seventh year, this program, we have a great following, a wonderful audience that has grown significantly, and I've learned so much hosting this program, just talking to so many wonderful people like yourself.
Oh,
so it's good to be
you.
Able to talk to you again.
I feel the same way.
Now, I want to talk about this book that you've written, and before we get to that, the bio that I read about you is really very, very small and compact, and you've done so many wonderful things for this movement. You were elected to the Vegetarian Hall of Fame in 2008, and so many other things. You've edited many books and guided many other people in writing their own books, and you've been a vegan for decades. The thing that amazes me is that I look at many cookbooks, as I know that you do, but you were really one of the founding people who have guided us with so many great recipes. And I don't even know that people really realize that when they're seeing some of the new cookbooks come out, that you were part of our foundation.
Thank you. I appreciate that. My books have been around for a long time, and I think I'm honored to think that perhaps some of the newer authors have used my recipes as foundations and jumping-off points for their innovative ideas. So thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome. And, you know, it can be frustrating sometimes, I don't know, because as the decades go on, some of the younger generations don't really realize how they got to where they are today. Things were harder decades ago.
Oh, is that true? That is so true. And I imagine that they get tired of us older folks talking about how hard it was way back when, but it was, and we didn't have all the advantages and all the products and all the prepared foods and all the information, including the web, decades ago. So things are quite different now, and it's amazing how much progress has been made so quickly.
Exactly. Now, the thing that I was surprised to find out is that you've struggled with IBS for a while. So
yes,
let's jump in and talk about that.
Yes. It's been actually quite a very long time that I have. And when I became vegan, which was, I don't want to say. It's been ages ago. longer than many vegans have, new vegans have been on the planet. But I had expected to feel better. And I think that most people, when they turn to a vegan diet and a vegan lifestyle, they do expect to feel better. And when they don't, they can be extremely disappointed. And it's hard to find support because most people actually have the opposite effect. They usually do feel that their health has improved, they've lost weight, their energy has risen when they take on a vegan diet. But for those of us, when that doesn't happen, it's hard to find support, and it's hard to tell other vegans that you don't feel good and you don't know why. And when you do, everybody has an answer. Everybody will tell you what you're doing wrong.
Yeah. Now, did you have trouble before you became a vegan?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You were very young when that happened.
Yes. Well, I had been a vegetarian before I became vegan, so I had been having a pretty healthful diet, especially compared to most people, for a long time. But when you have IBS, first of all, there's no structural damage to your intestinal tract. And it is very difficult and frustrating for physicians and the mainstream medical community to figure out what's wrong. And only recently has IBS been in the news and getting more attention. The low FODMAP diet in general, which is not geared towards vegans and is what makes this book unique, has been getting a significant amount of attention in the media recently, and that's awesome.
Now, can you tell us about the acronym FODMAP, what that means?
Okay. It is a group of difficult-to-digest carbohydrates. And everybody, to some degree or another, has difficulty with these particular carbohydrates in foods. The word FODMAP is an acronym it's words that most people won't know and won't relate to, so it's just easier to say FODMAP. It stands for the types of carbohydrates that are problematic for many people with IBS. And just like cholesterol is only found in animal products, FODMAPs are almost always only found in plant foods. There is lactose, which is found obviously in animal milk, and that is one of the FODMAPs, but all the others are found in plant foods.
Okay.
That's what makes being a vegan with IBS so very challenging.
Well, the other thing about all of that is, you know, we know in terms of most chronic diseases that plant foods are beneficial, especially for heart disease and diabetes. A high-fiber plant food diet is what boosts our immune system and lowers our risk. And yet for most people that discover they have irritable bowel syndrome, they're told not to consume fiber and they avoid vegetables and plants, the things that are beneficial. And I've always found for all diseases or all illnesses except this, plant foods tend to be the obvious answer to give you immediate relief. And yet this particular illness seems to go against that in some ways.
Well, in some ways it does. The problem is that the way that IBS works and the way that these short-chain carbohydrates work is that they ferment in our digestive tract. And depending on the type of IBS you have, these carbohydrates can go quickly through your digestive tract, or they can sit and ferment, or they can simply irritate the digestive tract and cause other problems such as bloating and gas and pain and all the things that nobody really wants to ever talk about in social settings. But the key to managing a vegan diet with IBS is to learn which foods are safe for you and which ones aren't. And so basically the low FODMAP diet is an elimination diet to start with. So it can help people with IBS pinpoint their trigger foods. And that way you don't have to eliminate everything for the rest of your life. You just have to find the foods that are specifically problematic for you. And you don't even have to totally eliminate those. Having a low FODMAP diet is about learning the portion size and frequency that you can have certain foods. So you might be able to have a tablespoon of legumes, but you might not be able to have much more than that.
Hmm.
So it's really sort of a learning process about what works for you. But the problem in the past has been we haven't been able to figure out what our triggers are. So most people with IBS, particularly vegans with IBS, have been afraid of food totally because we can't figure out what it is that's causing our problems. And there are many foods that do.
Yeah, this elimination diet that you spoke about, I think, is really important. The medical community wants to find one fix for a specific ailment. And this is where we discover we're all unique. And in many ways, not just with IBS, but many other illnesses, we're the best gauge to find out what's best for us. And very often an elimination diet, which can be a little challenging, but will let us know what works for each of us as an individual. And nobody else can do that.
Right. Well, the thing with the low FODMAP diet, and if somebody finds that they're sensitive to many, many foods, they can stick with the diet closely for a longer period. But usually people find that there are specific foods that cause them more problems than others. But like you said, everybody is different. And irritable bowel syndrome affects each person. In fact, all digestive issues affect each person uniquely. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all for everybody, unfortunately. I wish that there were. But there are certain foods that affect people more so than others, although, again, some people might not have any problem with those. But in particular, legumes, onions, and garlic are the big offenders.
This is fascinating to me, primarily because I'm a big fan of Dr. Joel Fuhrman, and he has some protocol for dealing with IBS, but his big thing is G-bombs, greens, beans,
right.
Onions, mushrooms, berries,
right.
And seeds.
Right, and a lot of those are high in FODMAPs. And just so listeners know, that FODMAPs are real. These have been proven scientifically, test after test, to exist and to exacerbate symptoms of IBS. So, and a lot of times, many of us want to feel that we're eating the best, most nutritious, most nutrient-dense diet possible. And so we might follow something like a nutritarian diet, and we don't feel better. And in large part, that's because we're eating foods that are triggering our symptoms, that are high in FODMAPs.
Have you made peace with your diet, Joe?
Am I at peace with it?
Yes. Are you at a good place with?
Well, it makes me laugh because IBS is unrelenting. And I would love to say I found the secret cure, but I haven't. I have found ways to manage my symptoms as best as I can, but I still have good days and bad days. And right. I've accepted that that's just the way it's going to be. But on my good days, I will experiment more with some of the higher FODMAP foods. And when I'm not feeling good, then I go back to a more strict low FODMAP vegan diet.
Mm-hmm. What are your triggers?
Everything.
It's just amazing to me that you've created so many wonderful cookbooks, and yet there's been some challenges along the way.
Well, I think when people come to veganism because of ethics, you really want to make it work, and you want to do everything in your power, and you just keep trying everything. And I have tried everything. I have had IBS for an extremely long time, and I have tried every approach imaginable, from oil-free and nutritarian to raw to food combining, you name it, I have tried it. I've tried fasting. I've tried juicing. I have tried absolutely everything. And that's why it does. It makes me laugh when people go, well, but have you tried this?
Yes.
And the answer is, yeah, I have. I wish that I had fewer triggers, but I can tolerate some things in moderation, some higher FODMAP foods on days when I'm feeling good. But there's really, right now, nobody knows exactly why people with irritable bowel syndrome feel better on some days and not on others, and why some foods are more tolerable on some days and not on others. It's difficult. That's what makes it so challenging and so frustrating for people who have it, because there currently are no answers. There's more being found out. There's more information in terms of physiological changes that are being detected that most of the medical community never thought existed. So that is creating opportunities for testing that allow people with IBS to get a diagnosis sooner and not have to travel from doctor to doctor to doctor getting nowhere. And then once they have this diagnosis, they can start taking action on their own, the personal steps that they need in terms of dietary changes, such as trying the low FODMAP diet, which has been effective for a large percentage of people with IBS.
Now, what about irritable bowel disease and Crohn's disease? I've often heard IBS lumped in with those other illnesses, and can you talk about them too? Because you don't really mention them.
Sure. Inflammatory bowel disease is different from irritable bowel syndrome in a number of ways, but symptomatically they can be very similar. There is structural damage to the intestines, depending on which type you have, whether you have Crohn's disease or you have ulcerative colitis, and that can be detected through examination. With irritable bowel syndrome, you can have an examination, such as a colonoscopy, and there will be no visible structural damage. These diseases, the IBD, the inflammatory bowel diseases, are progressive, and they also are very difficult to control. However, mild forms of IBD can be very similar to IBS in terms of symptoms. And people with severe IBS might even be more symptomatic and have more struggles with tasks of daily living than people with a very mild form of IBD. So right now, the very recent view of the gastrointestinal community, the physicians, is that digestive disorders are spectrum diseases, and so they can be all across the board. And regardless of which type you have, it can range from mild to severe.
I know that the drugs that they use for Crohn's disease, for example, can have tremendous side effects and also increase risk of cancer. So that's a very scary road to go down.
There really have been no good solutions and no headway into finding causes of IBD in the last 50 or more years. And the only solutions, which are pretty typical of the conventional medical community, have been new drugs. There have been really no ways to control, manage, and figure out the cause of inflammatory bowel disease. There's actually been a little more progress with irritable bowel syndrome than there has been with inflammatory bowel disease in the very recent years.
I've read about worms and about fecal
transplants.
What do they call it?
Yes, fecal transplants have been successful. They're not very appealing,
no.
But they have been successful with some people who have inflammatory bowel disease. They have not, as far as I know, been tried, at least not on any large scale, with people who have irritable bowel syndrome. And I can understand why, because our quality of life when you have IBS is deeply affected, but IBS does not progress. You don't have a risk of cancer, and you don't have a risk of IBS turning into IBD. IBS isn't life-threatening. So if we eat a food that is a trigger for us, the worst that happens is that we feel pretty rotten for several days. Mm-hmm. But with people who have IBD, their disease is progressive generally. Occasionally people do go into remission, and that's awesome. And that type of remission can last, for some people, for years. But that doesn't happen that frequently. And the disease can progress, and it can become life-threatening. It can require major surgeries. It's extremely serious in that regard.
So we've heard about IBS, and also we just briefly touched on Crohn's disease and IBD. Now let's go to the bright side and talk about your book and the recipes, because I like to say every time I've restricted my diet, going from an omnivore to a vegetarian, and a vegetarian to a vegan, and then a vegan to a raw vegan for a while, and every time I restrict foods, I discover a whole world of other plant foods that I never thought about trying. I'm not sure if it's the same with eating low FODMAP, but there are many, many foods that are safe.
Absolutely. That, you know, is true, and I've found that too. I find it kind of exciting to look for alternatives, and how can I satisfy my tastes when I can't have certain things? And so that was the fun of creating the recipes for this book, to think about what I can't have, what isn't available commercially, and how can I create something to fill that gap. For instance, ketchup. People love ketchup. It's a wonderful condiment, but it contains onion and garlic. People love sriracha sauce. That's a fabulous condiment these days, but it contains tons of garlic.
Right.
So I came up with options for both of them that are, I think, equally tasty, incredibly easy to make, and delicious, and last a really long time in the refrigerator, which is important. You don't have to make them that often. I came up with a wonderful chili paste, herbal seasonings and spices, and all kinds of things to fill the gaps that are there when you have to restrict your diet, especially in terms of garlic and onion, which is, both of those are ubiquitous. They're in everything. If you go to any store and look at the prepared foods, the deli, I'm talking about vegan foods, the deli, the packaged foods, the frozen items, the veggie burgers, the cheese alternatives, you name it, they have onion and garlic in them. It is so difficult for people with IBS to find solutions that don't contain those two items if you're looking for a savory food. So
I'm thinking of the Jane cuisine where they don't believe in using onion and garlic. Is there any connection with IBS and the Janes?
Not that I'm aware of. Although Janes in general have, there's a movement toward veganism, but Janes in general have used dairy products in the past.
Right.
So they don't get away with that one.
That's true. But I just wonder why they don't eat, what the real reason behind not eating onions and garlic from centuries ago.
From what I understand, and I am not Jane, but from what I understand in terms of the connection between not eating onion and certain strict Hindus and, for instance, the Hare Krishnas, they do not use onion and garlic either. And it's for spiritual reasons that they would probably be able to explain a whole lot better than I could. But... it has to do with making your mind work in a way that it shouldn't. That's not very spiritual in terms of how active it is. So I will let somebody from those those backgrounds explain that. But
Do you have in the cookbook some of your favorite go-to comfort foods that are safe?
Oh, I think they're all comfort foods because that's what I'm big into. And when you're not feeling good, you really do want something that's going to make you feel soothed and comforted and loved because you don't want to feel deprived. So I try to make everything high in flavor, soft and tender, just really appealing, whether you're feeling great or whether you're not. So, and there's all kinds of different types of recipes, too. I have a coconut curry. I've got Indian-style chard and potatoes and carrots and smoothies and short ribs, barbecue sauce, but all low in FODMAPs and all mild enough that they won't inflame a sensitive digestive system.
I'm very glad to see that kale and collard greens are on the safe list.
So was I. Two of my favorite foods. There, you know, it's when it comes to low FODMAPs, dietitians are often saying, and physicians are often saying, that you really do need to have a dietitian guide you through the process so that you don't get any deficiencies in any nutrients. But we also hear that same thing when we become vegan. And people say, well, you're going to be missing out on so many nutrients. And what, though? Really? I have to ask myself, what? Because I look at what you can have on a low FODMAP vegan diet, and you can have a lot. But it's just knowing what. You can have, there are plenty of safe fruits, there are plenty of safe vegetables, there are safe nuts and seeds, and there are even a couple safe legumes in the right portion size. So there's really not a lot that we're missing out on in terms of nutrition, but it is a matter of understanding the portion that isn't usually a trigger for most people, finding out your specific triggers. But there's lots that we can have. The primary challenge is prepared foods and eating out. Those are the biggest hurdles.
Yeah, I understood that, and I was kind of, my heart was breaking for all people that are suffering from irritable bowel syndrome and living in this modern social world. the restaurants and prepared food manufacturers are getting better when it comes to all kinds of allergies and gluten and nuts and even labeling things vegan, but they're not there yet when it comes to onions and garlic. Oh my goodness.
And I keep trying to reach out, but nobody seems to be listening right now. In Australia, where this research was conducted originally and where it's emanated from, they actually have a low FODMAP insignia for food products. Just like we have for vegan products, it's not the vegan insignia on foods, on food products here isn't really controlled by any one organization, but they do have that for low FODMAP foods in Australia, and it would be wonderful to have something like that here in the United States.
Okay, I'm sure it will come, and hopefully sooner than later. And thank you once again for leading the way with food with your latest book, your low FODMAP and vegan diet book.
Thank you, Karen.
Yes, thanks for joining me again, and feel good.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's move on. So thank you, Joe Stepaniak, for joining me today on It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass, and let's move on, shall we? So I would like to just briefly talk a little bit about what's been going on with me. As I mentioned earlier, we've been traveling around California this last month, and you know, talking with Joe, who's been vegan for so long, it makes me think about the vegan restaurants and products that were available 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago when some of us were looking around for them. And I was recently at the Staff of Life Market in Santa Cruz. And I used to go there in the 80s and 90s when I lived in California. And there was nowhere else to go for vegan food. And they had wonderful treats and desserts and sandwiches. It was always such a special place. And I was driving around Santa Cruz a few days ago, and I saw their new building that they moved to in 2011, and I went in, and I was really delighted and surprised that I still felt this magical feeling in there. They just have a lovely atmosphere, and even though we're fortunate to have so many more grocery stores, supermarkets that have wonderful vegan products today, I was glad to feel that there was still something special at the Staff of Life Market. Okay, let us move to my next guest, Julie Guerraseva, the founder of Leica Magazine. Welcome to It's All About Food, Julie. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. So I want to hear more about your vegan lifestyle magazine, Leica. It's especially fun to talk to you now because I was just talking to Joe Stepaniak. I don't know if you know of her. But she has created so many cookbooks and was really created so much groundwork for many other cookbook authors and chefs to build upon. She had so many great cheesy recipes and saucy recipes decades ago, and I've just seen so much evolution from her, so it's kind of fun to talk about that. And now we're talking to you, and you have this new great magazine and talking about all of the new vegan entrepreneurs and people that are out there moving this movement forward.
Yeah, so Leica is essentially what you're describing. It's a showcase of the vibrancy and how relevant and contemporary the vegan movement is, and the magazine in particular, Leica. What's a little unique about it is that it has a really wide range of content. So there's profiles of really compelling individuals within the vegan movement, celebrities who are very outspoken about being vegan, like Kat Von D, who's on the cover of the newest issue, which is the sixth edition. So the magazine is young, but it's now in its sixth issue. And And then alongside of that, there's very candid and unflinching investigative stories, investigative journalism, and reporting on animals, the situation they're in, and also the complexity of their lives. So it's presenting animals in a whole new light alongside human beings. So it's showcasing the vegan lifestyle and its, you know, incredible range that includes, you know, food and travel and fun stuff like that, as well as activism, or rights activism, and the lives of animals. So it's really showing the whole experience in a really immersive and compelling way. That's essentially what, you know, a mainstream magazine like Vanity Fair would do for, you know, human interest stories as a whole. So it's just, it's at the end of the day, it's an interesting magazine with very inventive, engaging stories on a wide range of topics that just happen to be vegan, which to me is the vegan experience in a nutshell. It's full of interesting people who live interesting lives, who in many ways are just like everybody else, but it's just that their lives happen to be, they happen to live their lives fully without relying in any way on the exploitation of animals, you know. So it's really a new kind of cutting edge model for living, which I think history of humankind is really pushing us towards, as world events are showing. So
I love that. Let's push more towards that. And the beauty in your magazine and about the vegan lifestyle is that there is no deprivation. We can exactly. have it all, and we can have more than it all. That's how I feel about it. I'm continually telling people when it comes exactly. to the food, you don't know how good you can feel. And
yeah, exactly. In fact, I would say, contrary to the stereotypes, it's not a lifestyle of deprivation. It's a lifestyle of liberation and freedom, because you're widening your horizons and your experiences in ways you didn't know existed before. After you like untangle yourself from all these status quos that actually limit our experience on this planet as human beings, you know, we're constantly putting kind of restrictions on ourselves in many ways, on how we interact with the rest of the world and being in touch with our feelings, which is also very stifling. As a vegan, you get to experience life fully, and you allow yourself to experience your full range of feelings as a human being, which includes compassion and empathy and kindness, you know, all those basic human emotions that we've kind of like denied ourselves.
That's really good. It's almost when we remove the toxic food and the food that's coating our arteries and clogging our brain, physically we're clearing, we're detoxing, but it's also a clearing and detoxing and a clarity giving experience for our emotions.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a very multifaceted experience.
Right on. Go vegan. Period. Yeah. Now, you just have a few issues out. You're new. And I noticed in the 7 years of doing this program every week, talking to many different wonderful people, I have learned so much. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what have you learned since you started this magazine?
Oh my gosh, so much. I was actually thinking about that today, is that as a result of doing the magazine, how much I've learned about everything from like animal sentience, you know, the depth of their emotional world, to, you know, cutting edge activism techniques to how to approach talking to people about veganism, about the vegan movement in different parts of the world, what's happening. It's sort of like I really intentionally go into material for each issue that is also new to me, because I want to learn new stuff. And with every issue, I'm just astounded by the wealth of information that is just, it's so just enriching and just gorgeous, like, information that I come across, like, I, you know, discovering that there's a vegan scene in Central and Eastern Europe and Prague and Warsaw that's, like, really dynamic, and they do interesting things there with their animal rights organizations that we might not be doing here. So the magazine is also a really intentional kind of vehicle for cross-pollination of ideas and experiences, so that someone, it has an international, it's available internationally, it has an international readership, and its content, although primarily dealing with topics, stories dealing in the United States, there's also tons of stuff from other parts of the world. So it's really like bringing together the global vegan experience, which is really fascinating.
You mentioned animal sentience before, and I love hearing these stories about other species. I was just talking with Jonathan Balcombe a few weeks ago with his new book, What a Fish Knows.
Oh, yeah, that's a great book.
It's such a great book, and I especially love the way he wrote it, because I think it's very approachable or very appealing to even those people who are fish eaters. They're just lovely, amazing stories, but then I hope those that read it can make the leap. Fish are not friends. Fish are your friends, not food, everybody.
And that's what I try to do with every animal-related feature in Laika. I really aim to kind of humanize animals. Like, there's a story in the new issue called Enduring Bond that's all about really close friendships between animals. And I deliberately brought together stories from a multitude of sanctuaries from around the world. There's two international sanctuaries and five from all over the United States. And it's just mind-blowing the types of stories and the photographs that show the closeness that these animals experience, that is so much like the human experience, that you read that, you know, you see that and you read those stories, which show like the process of animals bonding, how they get to know each other, how they kind of gravitate towards certain kinds of animals, like they click with some, they don't click with others, just like people do. You know, they grieve over loss in a very overt way, just like human beings. So our experiences, we have so many commonalities, which is what the theme of the new issue is, which is the unity issue, which explores the commonalities between human beings and between us and the animal kingdom and planet Earth, and the importance of being unified. So
unity is a great concept right now. As humans, we're still struggling unifying with our own species. Mm-hmm. We're struggling with borders around countries. Yeah. You know, we all share the same home, planet Earth. We all breathe the same air, drink the same water, and yet we're still struggling with being unified within ourselves. This refugee crisis, the Brexit, the vote that just happened. We need unity.
So that was sort of it. It was a very organic kind of result from. Resulted from just living, seeing what's happening around the world, and also as a vegan movement, it's so important to be unified. And I think really the core of unity is just really honing in our commonalities, the most important things that that tie us together. You know, we all share the same values at the end of the day. And those same values are important to animals, like happiness, feeling safe, safe from harm, enjoying your surroundings, valuing freedom, those very basic needs without which we can't live and which we all need. That's what unites us, and we can provide that for each other just by simply respecting one another, you know? So it's really about kind of striving for coexistence, which I think is the only way we're going to all survive on this planet. The only way our planet is going to survive is if we learn to coexist. So I think it's really important to put this kind of those kinds of messages out there. You know, this is my way of doing it with the magazine, and we can all do it every single day.
Again, I'm going to say I love this unity concept. I'm going to go with it here for a little longer.
Yeah.
You know, even vegans have challenges being unified within our own community. There's a lot of anger, and it's just something we definitely need to work on. But the idea of realizing all the things that we have in common on this planet is the only way we're really going to make connections. I'm thinking right now, I think it was 2 years ago, I was invited to speak to 250 cattle producers the night before a bull sale, and they were having a conversation about animal agriculture's contribution to global warming. And I went as the lone vegan. I was decked out in all my vegan cowboy wear. And I was trying to think, how can I have a conversation with these people and have them hear me? Which is really, that was my goal. I wasn't expecting them to change. I just wanted to be heard. And I focused on the things we all wanted. We all want clean air and good food to eat, and we all want good health, and we want peace. And it was really important to make that connection, because I don't think we can make change or move at all until we all like hold hands and realize what we all share, what we all want.
That's essentially it.
Unfortunately, some people will say, well, what I want is bacon.
You know, it's a complex thing, and you know, there's a multitude of approaches. You know, I really believe in a diversity of tactics, and I believe in kind of disarming people with kindness and like listening to them, trying to understand them, because people get so defensive. I mean, food is probably the most personal, the most controversial topic, you know, possibly, you know, one of the most controversial for sure ever. People take it very personally. They see it as like a personal freedom. But if we take a step back and we just recognize that these are just society's status quos and social norms that have been imposed on people that are not necessary, we just kind of deconstruct the situation, then it becomes a little easier to manage, so that if someone is coming at you with the bacon jokes, you kind of stuck and realize like, well, you know, they're still under that state of kind of not seeing clearly and subscribing to these outdated status quos, but this is where I come in and I help them to come out of that. And, you know, that's another thing I've learned through the magazine, is just different techniques and different approaches, and there's so many different ways to handle it. But I really have so much, I'm just an optimist by nature, but also because of my background. I was born in Russia. I grew up still in the under the communist, the communist regime was still intact. Wow. And I lived through that system falling apart. So I saw with my own eyes a whole regime that was so ingrained in society just come tumbling down. And now that I'm vegan and having been vegan for about 8 years and everything I've learned, you know, I think back on that and I realize, like, anything is possible. What you think seems far-fetched, you know, don't assume that it's not possible. So I don't underestimate anybody. I believe that most people are capable of you know, seeing the light, so to speak. It's just that some require a different approach. There's different approaches. You know, and I think, I'm thinking more of like, let's get to the tipping point, that, you know, let's get to that 10%. And after that, I think momentum will really take over. And
absolutely. Well, you know, I think it's part of human nature. We're most of us are followers. Mm-hmm. And once we reach that tipping point, then yes, we will have this great momentum because people will follow. And many of us in the first world, or however we call ourselves, developed, I don't even know what the PC word is today, for
Western
the nation.
Society.
Excuse me?
Western society.
Western, anyway, yeah. We have so many conveniences. People don't want to give up conveniences. They don't want to change. And when they begin to see that they can have it all, as I mentioned before, and it's easy, and they don't have to change very much, then they'll go for it naturally.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of like nudging people a little out of their comfort zones. And yes, change can be scary, but change is also like really exhilarating. People just don't give it a chance, you know? So it's just a matter of kind of like luring people over that line that they're afraid to cross, and before they even realize that they're like on the other side and they're enjoying themselves, you know? So yes, it's a huge challenge, you know, I'm not under any illusion that it's not a huge challenge. It is. But I believe that, you know, it's doable. It has to be. It has to be, because I don't think.
Okay, so the newest issue, where can people find it?
So people can get it at LaikaMagazine.com, L-A-I-K-A magazine.com, online. And then it's going to be available in about a week, week to 10 days, on newsstands around the country and internationally, and various independent bookstores. So they can just check the site and check various social media pages that the magazine has, which are all on Instagram. It's the handle is Laika Magazine, and Twitter and Facebook, it's facebook.com/Laika Magazine, to keep up with the latest stuff. We're going to be putting out more like exclusive behind the scenes videos from our cover shoot and other fun stuff. And yeah, I'm really proud of this issue. I think it's really inspiring and uplifting, and is really going to move people and move them to action.
And can you tell us a little bit more of some of the features that are in this magazine that you didn't mention earlier?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's the feature with Kat Von D. She's the vegan tattoo artist, and she has a vegan. She has a cruelty-free makeup line that she's making vegan. And she, we photographed her at Farm Sanctuary. So she's with all these beautiful rescued animals. It's a really beautiful story, a really inspiring story. And there's travel stories on Prague, Warsaw, and Vancouver. There's a feature on coyotes, foxes, and wolves, and their sentience and how they're persecuted unfairly, even though many people don't realize they're actually cousins of the domestic dog. There's a really awesome feature that I love about, that's a series of conversations between vegans from different generations, vegan trailblazers like Mark Beckoff, and vegan teens. So they exchange like really interesting perspectives and ideas on vegan history and vegan future. It's just another example, it ties in with the unity issue and another example of cross-pollinating ideas. And I think it's really important to get the perspective of different generations. There's really beautiful food stories. There's a really beautiful food story about that's really kind of like also, it ties in also with the unity theme, that's really like vegetable forward and inspired by kind of the bounty of the plant kingdom. There's a really wonderful interview with activist Mark Chang, who is fighting the dog meat trade in Asia. You may have heard, is a really poignant interview with him, and a feature with Tony Canal, who's the bassist for No Doubt. He's a vegan musician and activist who has
That sounds great. I'm very excited to hear about it, and we're out of time.
Okay.
So thanks for joining me so much, and
absolutely.
The best of luck with Leica Magazine, Julie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, you're welcome. That was Julie Guerra-Seva. Be well. And I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. I just wanted to mention before we go, at responsibleeatingandliving.com, my nonprofit, we just hit day 500 of our daily blog, What Vegans Eat. So I hope you're reading it, enjoying it, and we post every day what we eat here in my family at Responsible Eating and Living, with recipes and ideas for you. Hope you're enjoying it. Thanks for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. And remember, tune in live here at Progressive Radio Network. Tuning in, love, and have a delicious week.